Well, we might as well finish up. We got up to slide 8. I haven't talked about this yet, though. But the new subject that's being explained in this slide is called gene linkage. Now, be careful with this, because earlier we talked about genes that are sex-linked, right? Sex-linked and gene linkage are totally different things, even though they both have the word link in them. First, let's quickly remember what a sex-linked gene is. What does that mean? No. That's a sex chromosome. Yeah, what is a sex-linked gene? Exactly. That's all sex-linked means, that the gene is on a sex chromosome, as opposed to being on any other kind of chromosome, which are called the autosomes. So any given gene is either autosomal or it's sex-linked. And that determination applies to any individual gene. Right? Any one gene is either sex-linked or it's not. Now we're going to talk about genes being linked. And gene linkage does not make any sense for a single gene. It doesn't make any sense to say whether one gene is linked. For genes to be linked, you have to be talking about two different genes. All right? And all the phrase means is that, for two genes to be linked, that is that those two genes are on the same chromosome, regardless of what type of chromosome it is. It can be an autosome or a sex chromosome, but if two genes are on the same chromosome, then they are, by definition, linked. All right? Now let's look at this slide and see what this has to do with gene linkage. This involves fruit flies again, but no eye color here. We're paying attention to two different characteristics here. One of which is body color. And notice it's a hybrid cross. The two parents are different in their body color. Gray is the dominant body color. Black is the mutant form, which is also recessive. So gray is not only dominant, it's wild type, meaning most of them have that color. The other characteristic is wing shape. And the dominant and wild type version is a full wing, like you see in the one on the left, the parent on the left. The mutant version gives rise to what are called vestigial wings, very much reduced in size, these little stubs. So in this cross, the two parents differ in their traits, but each parent is doubly homozygous. This one is homozygous dominant for body color, gray, and homozygous dominant for wing shape. This uses that same kind of backwards notation as we saw for eye color, where the initial of the genotype is for the recessive instead of the dominant. So B here stands for black. But if you have the gray allele instead, then it's B with a plus. B by itself means black. B plus means gray. And similarly, VG stands for vestigial, but VG plus means full wing. VG by itself means vestigial wing. So this one is B plus, B plus, VG plus, VG plus, because it's double homozygous dominant. This one's B, B, VG, VG, because it's double homozygous recessive. None of that is new. We know those concepts already. Also not new is the fact that when you have two true breeding parents that differ in their traits, then every one of the F1s that they produce are going to be heterozygous. Right, by definition. So you see one of the F1s right here, but they would all look the same way. They would all have the genotype B plus B, VG plus VG, double heterozygous. But since we're talking about complete dominance for both of these genes, that means phenotypically every one of the F1s are going to be gray-bodied, the dominant color, and full-winged, the dominant shape. All right? All of that's the same as in other crosses we've looked at. But now we're doing a test cross. Instead of crossing two F1s like we've been doing in a lot of these crosses, we're going to cross this F1 with a double homozygous recessive individual. This black and vestigial winged individual. And even though it really doesn't matter because this isn't sex-linked, this one happens to be the male. The F1 chosen here happens to be a female. Well, since the male is double homozygous recessive, that means he can make only one kind of gamete, only one kind of sperm with respect to body color and wing shape. Because it doesn't matter which B you choose, doesn't matter which VG the meiosis chooses, you're going to get a BVG sperm. That's why the Punnett square has only one row. The F1 female, though, is double heterozygous, so she can make four different kinds of eggs. Meiosis can randomly choose the B plus and the VG plus, the B plus and the VG, the B and the VG plus, or the B and the VG. Those are here. Okay? So the Punnett square, as usual, shows you the predicted outcome for the offspring. Okay, the reason this is being done, this test cross, is to determine whether these two different genes, which are the body color gene and the wing shape gene, are linked. Meaning, are they on the same chromosome as each other or not? Those are one of those has to be true, right? That's an exhaustive list of possibilities. Well, look here at the predicted ratios. If you assume that the genes are linked, that means if genes are located on different chromosomes, then they can move in different directions. Last time we talked a little bit about the fact that even though we kind of learned it as though genes are acting independently, moving around independently, they're not, right? Any individual gene is really just one of many gene passengers on a chromosome. And wherever the chromosome goes, all of the genes on that chromosome go. Well, if two different genes are on different chromosomes, they can go the same way or different ways from each other because the chromosomes can either go the same way or different from each other. You see what I'm saying here? That's why linkedness can matter. If we assume that the genes are not linked, they're on different chromosomes, then you should expect all possible phenotypes in the offspring. All four of these should be equally possible. By the way, look at these four possibilities. This type of individual is gray-bodied and full-winged, which is just like one of the original parents. This one is black-bodied and vestigial-winged, which is just like one of the original parents. So these two types belong to a category called parental-type offspring. They're like one parent or the other. But these two are not like either parent. It's like a combination of both parents. This one has the color of one parent and the wings of the other parent. This one has the color of one the other parent and the wings of the other parent. All right. So these two types, not being like either parent, but a combination of them, are called recombinant types offspring. Well, the point here is that if the color gene and the wing shape gene are on different chromosomes, then it's possible for them to go to the same cell, same gamete, and it's also possible for them to go to different gametes. And therefore, you should expect all four of these possibilities. And they would all equally be probable, or they would be of equal probability. That's why the expected ratio, if the two genes are not linked, is 1:1:1:1. Does that make sense on probabilistic grounds? All right, well, the only alternative, of course, is that they are linked. That's what this second sentence is. If genes are located on the same chromosome and parental alleles are always inherited together, that's referring to linkedness. You know, to the color gene and the wing-shaped gene are on the same chromosome. That means wherever the chromosome goes, both of those alleles go. Right? Because they're just passengers. And in that case, you wouldn't expect the color gene and the wing-shaped gene to separate. They're both riding on the same boat. And therefore, you would expect only parental-type offspring. You shouldn't be able to mix and match into the recombinant types. That's why the expected ratio, if they are linked, would be a 1:1:0:0. These two would be impossible, in other words, according to that prediction. Well, look at the actual results. The numbers here are real. These are real results when they actually did this test cross. And neither of these predicted ratios came true. First of all, there are some recombinants, 206 and 185, which is obviously more than zero. So it kind of says this must not be true. But also, it's not 1:1:1:1. And these are big enough numbers for it to be, it should be pretty close to 1:1:1 if it's not linked, if they are not linked. So neither prediction actually came completely true. Well, the fact that there is such a deviation from 1:1:1:1 means that they are not, they are linked. Because if two genes are truly not linked, they're on different chromosomes, then these should definitely be equally probable. So the fact that there's so few recombinants means that they are linked. But why is it that you can get recombinants even though they are linked? What happens that you know about that can cause two alleles that are on the same chromosome originally to separate from each other and go to different cells?
Crossing over.
Exactly. Crossing over explains why two linked genes can actually recombine or create recombinant offspring. Now, let me draw a picture here real quick to explain what I'm talking about. This is what crossing over looks like, right? This, what is this point called? The point of crossover. The chiasma. Right, and when they cross over, they don't just cross over, they swap the part that's downstream of the chiasma. So this green part is part of this formerly all red chromosome, and this red part is part of this formerly all green chromosome. All right, that's just crossing over as we've already learned it. If two genes are linked, they're on the same chromosome. So let's say the positions of those, or the loci of those two genes are here and here. If that happens, then crossing over doesn't affect that, right? They're still going to go together. And also, if they're here and here, they're going to go together. The only way they're going to be separated by crossing over is if the chiasma forms between the two loci. Does that make sense to you? So that would be this situation. In all three of these, they're linked because they're on the same chromosome. But if they're linked and a chiasma forms because of crossing over between those two positions, those two loci, then they're going to be separated and go to be part of different chromosomes. All right, so think about this in terms of the probability of that happening. If two genes are linked, but they're on very far apart from each other, on opposite ends of the chromosome, then just about every time crossing over occurs, they're going to be separated, which means they're going to behave as though they are not linked. But the closer the two loci are together, the less probable it's going to be for a chiasma to randomly form between them. It's going to form somewhere else. And therefore, they will not be separated. And the less often they're separated, the less often you'll get recombinant types, because you have to have separation of them for the recombinant types to exist. Is this clear? Well, the next slide shows you this in pictures using these cartoons for the chromosome involved. There's only one chromosome type shown here. We ignore the rest because this is the one chromosome type that carries both of these genes. The loci are listed in black. And in this case, a crossing over can occur, a chiasma can form anywhere along the length. But only if it forms between those two loci are these two alleles going to be separated from each other, causing a recombinant type. Well, at the bottom here, we have what's called a recombination frequency. This is a calculation that a graduate student decades ago came up with. This is back way before we could just look at DNA. We couldn't sequence DNA. And so he figured out, well, I can actually mathematically determine how close two linked genes are. First, you, by doing various crosses, you can determine whether they're linked or not. But if you keep doing crosses for two genes, paying attention to two genes, and you keep getting 1:1:1:1 ratios, that means they're not linked. But if you start getting deviations from 1:1:1:1, then whatever two genes you're doing at that point must be linked. And what he figured out is, well, I can tell how close together they are on the chromosome by looking at how often the recombinants come about in the offspring. The smaller the occurrence of the recombinant types, the closer they must be together, the two genes. And he just defined that mathematically as the recombination frequency. So in this case, that 391 is just the total number of recombinants, 206 plus 185. And the 2300 is all of the offspring, all these four added together. And you just multiply it by 100 to make it a percentage of the recombinant types. And the smaller that is, he deduced, the closer the two linked genes must be to each other. In other words, he was able to do the first gene mapping. Gene mapping is, and we're on slide 10 now, gene mapping is a way to figure out the relative positions of genes that are on the same chromosome. So knowing they're linked is important, but that's only part of the information. You want to know where they are with respect to each other. Well, this is kind of an old-fashioned example now because it's pretty routine to sequence DNA nowadays. We can actually know exactly where the genes are with respect to each other. We couldn't do that then. And so by doing a bunch of crosses, paying attention to two characteristics at a time and calculating recombination frequencies, you can start mapping. For instance, here there are three genes involved, but you would do separate experiments paying attention to two of those three at a time. The B gene and the VG gene had a recombination frequency of 17%. B and CN, 9%. CN and VG, 9.5%. So that means logically, this larger recombination frequency means these must be farther apart than either of the other two are to each other, and you can figure out the relative positions of them. That's gene mapping. 11 shows you the same thing, just with some more genes. And the zero here, by the way, is just this one is it at one end or the other. The zero is kind of artificial. It just means the starting point and all these other numbers are relative to it. All right. Let's talk about 12 now. Well, hopefully you remember meiosis, which is involved here. Meiosis, before I get to that, let me say, give you another definition. Any given cell, depending on the species and the cell type, any type of cell has a certain normal number of chromosomes, meaning the number of chromosomes that it's supposed to have for that cell type and that species. And we call the normal number of chromosomes for a cell, or we call a cell euploid if it has the normal number. Eu means true or good, just like in eukaryote, true nucleus. If a cell has anything other than the euploid number, the correct number of chromosomes for that cell type, then we use the antonym of this. You make this an antonym by putting AN in front of it. Aneuploid means having some abnormal number of chromosomes, which can happen either of two ways. You can have too many chromosomes or too few chromosomes for the cell type. Either one of those situations is aneuploidy. And aneuploidy can come about because of accidental mistakes that occur in meiosis. Meiosis, remember, involves two cell divisions. So this can actually happen in meiosis 1 or meiosis 2, because each of those involves a separation event, right? What actual subphase involves the separation? Right, and so there's anaphase 1 and anaphase 2. Both of those separate things, but different things. And therefore, a mistake can happen in either one of those. Well, normally, meiosis goes off without a hitch. No error made. And what I mean by that is that whatever is supposed to separate, depending on whether it's anaphase 1 or anaphase 2, does separate. That normal separation is called disjunction, which is just another word for separation. It's the adjective of disjoin. I mean, it's the noun form of disjoin. And that's what's occurring for this tetrad right here. This was a former tetrad, right? It's a homologous pair that was joined, and it properly separated. So that's normal disjunction. But sometimes that doesn't happen. That's the error, and that error is called non-disjunction. So this tetrad is not disjoining. And that means the two daughter cells that get created as the direct result of meiosis 1 are now both aneuploid, but for different reasons. This one doesn't get either chromosome from the tetrad. This one gets both. So this cell is aneuploid because it has too many chromosomes, abnormally high number. This one an abnormally low number. Which, by the way, would you expect to be the more serious problem? having too many or having too few chromosomes? Too few, because if you don't have any of that type of chromosome, that means you don't have any of those genes. You can't make any of the proteins that those genes correspond to. Very hard to survive that. But having too many, even though you have all of the genes, having too many of them can also cause problems. Anyway, these two daughter cells of meiosis I are already aneuploid, and even if meiosis II goes off normally, so to speak, all four of these gametes are going to be aneuploid because you started with aneuploid cells from the interim. On the other hand, non-disjunction can also occur in meiosis II. Here, meiosis I is normal. Everything disjoins normally the first time, meaning that the homologs separate. The homologs making up the tetrad separate normally in meiosis I. But then in this one daughter cell, non-disjunction occurs in meiosis II, so the chromatids don't separate from each other. That means these two gametes are aneuploid, but the other daughter cell undergoes normal, again, separation, and therefore these two gametes are normal. Anyway, if you have an aneuploid gamete that's formed because of non-disjunction, and that gamete randomly gets chosen to be the one that's involved in fertilization, then that means you're going to have an aneuploid zygote, and therefore all of the cells that zygote becomes to develop the person or whatever kind of offspring will be aneuploid as well. Here we're looking at just some major categories of what are called chromosomal mutations. We've discussed mutations several times already, but up to now we've been talking about small-scale mutations. Small-scale doesn't mean that they don't cause big problems. It just means that the mutation itself, which remember, any mutation has to be a change in the DNA sequence. Small-scale mutations involve just one or a small number of nucleotide pairs, like the sickle cell example I gave you. So, you know, it can involve, if it occurs in a gene, which it doesn't even have to, it can occur between genes, but if a small-scale mutation occurs, or a point mutation as it's called, occurs in a gene, it can cause that gene to be different, but all the rest of the genes are more or less unaffected. Here we're talking about much larger scale mutations. These are chromosomal mutations occurring at the level of the chromosome, involving a huge chunk of the chromosome. So, before we get to these individual categories, let me just say A, B, C, D, and so on, those are not genes. Those are just major chunks of the chromosome. And so there are many genes within A, there are many genes within B, and so on. Because there's thousands of genes on the overall chromosome. Well, anyway, deletion is what it says. Something gets deleted. In this case, the D chunk, because of whatever accident, gets taken out. So you go from A, B, C, D, E to A, B, C, E. Well, that means you're missing now all of the genes that are in that section. And so that's going to affect a lot of things, right? Chromosomal mutations have very widespread effects because of that. Duplication is, for whatever reason, one chunk being copied and put end to end to the original copy. So ABCD turns into ABC, BC again, and then DEF. Well, this one's a lot more easy to survive, which hopefully makes sense to you, because you have your original normal genes in the BC region, and now you have a second copy of all those genes as well. That might cause problems, but maybe not as well. And this is why this is survivable a lot of times. And as a matter of fact, that second copy of all those genes kind of can be experimented with by natural selection, because it doesn't matter what happens to them since you have the original ones still, and sometimes they can change many times, still surviving until they become something that's more useful. Anyway, that's duplication. Inversion, to invert means to turn around. So inversion here, a chunk gets right, left, twisted. So A, B, C, D, E turns into A, D, C, B, E. So notice here, you're not adding or taking away any DNA. You're just flipping part of the sequence. Well, for one thing, depending on where the cut occurs, you could be cutting in the middle of a gene. If a gene straddles this line, then you would be ruining that gene, right? So that would be an effect. But remember, I said that actually the sequence that's in all of your genes combined is only about 1% of your DNA. So there's huge stretches between the genes. And therefore, if you randomly cut it, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to cut right into a gene. But even if these two cuts before it flips do not cut a gene itself, that doesn't mean the gene can be unaffected. And that's because one function of these non-coding stretches that are between genes is to be involved in regulating the expression of the genes themselves. A healthy cell has to correctly control the expression of the genes. You don't want a gene to be turned on continuously, unless it's supposed to be. Otherwise, you're going to be making that protein when you're not supposed to be making it. And of course, you don't want it to be able to not be turned on, which is like not having the gene to begin with. So an inversion mutation might affect that control of the genes. The most complicated of the ones shown here is the reciprocal translocation, because that involves two different chromosomes, two types of chromosomes. These aren't homologs. These are two different chromosomes, non-homologous, and a chunk of one of them and a chunk of the other get swapped for each other. So now all of the genes in MNO and AB find themselves on the wrong chromosome. And so even if the genes themselves aren't damaged, just like in the previous example, the control of them might be, and so it can cause problems. In fact, slide 14 shows you a specific occurrence of reciprocal translocation that occurs fairly often in humans, involving chromosome 9 and chromosome 22. This is known as the Philadelphia mutation. It creates what's called the Philadelphia chromosome. And it's just an example of reciprocal translocation, but in humans what this causes is leukemia. I mean, there's plenty of other ways you can get leukemia, but this is one way that leukemia is caused. And that leaves only 15 for the term. And I don't want to get too deeply into this except to mention that this is an example of an epigenetic event or epigenetic effect. An epigenetic effect is something that can change the phenotype, the trait, in other words, without actually changing the DNA sequence. That's another way of saying without mutation, right? Mutation certainly can change the phenotype, but mutation, by definition, is a change to the DNA sequence, and that's why it affects the phenotype. But epigenetics is about something happening that does not change the DNA sequence, but still the phenotype is affected. Well, if you think back to the last time, we talked about X chromosome inactivation, the cat example, right? That was an example of epigenetics. I just didn't use the word back then, but that's one example. Here we have another example that's called genomic imprinting. And genomic imprinting is a little bit like X chromosome inactivation, except on a gene-by-gene basis rather than inactivating the entire chromosome. And as a fraction of the total number of genes, pretty few genes are imprinted, but some of them are. What it means, though, in imprinting is that the two alleles that a diploid organism has are different because they come from different parents, right? You have a maternal version and a paternal version for any gene. You have two alleles for that gene, right? One from your mother, one from your father. There's two major kinds of imprinting, paternal imprinting and maternal imprinting, which depends on the gene as to which kind it is. But in maternal imprinting, the paternal version is turned off for the lifetime of that offspring. And the maternal version coming from the mother is active. Now, this is done usually by what's called methylation of DNA. You stick a bunch of methyl groups onto that stretch of DNA that is that gene, and that will keep the gene from being able to be expressed. It can't be transcribed. So it keeps it off for the lifetime of that individual. All right, but it does so, I mean, it happens based on where that chromosome came from, either the father or the mother. This example, using the mice, is paternal imprinting because the paternal version, the one that came from the father, is left alone, and the maternal version is methylated and turned off. The top example is a homozygous mouse. So this mouse got its two alleles from its two parents, but they're the same version. They're both normal versions of what is a gene that codes for a growth factor, which determines how big the mouse gets. Since it's homozygous, it doesn't really matter whether it's the mother's or the father's that gets turned off, but it's paternal imprinting, so the mother's gets turned off. That leaves him or her, with one normal gene, which is why it's normal-sized. There's two different cases for heterozygotes, though, on the bottom. This mouse got a normal version from his father, and that one's going to stay on because it's paternal imprinting, and the mutant form from the mother. But because of imprinting, the mother's version always gets turned off, so he's left with just one normal, and he's normal size. Just the opposite for the other heterozygote, though. He got an abnormal from the father. That's the one that's going to be allowed to stay on, and a normal one from the mother that gets turned off, so he grows up not quite as much. He's much smaller in adulthood. Anyway, that's another example of an epigenetic effect, and it's called genomic imprinting. And I have now taught you all you need to know to get to 100% on when?
Monday.
What time? Yes, you're meeting at the regular time. So we're stopping a little earlier, but I'll see you in just a bit in the laboratory. By the way...